141 HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we are talking all things Howard University with President Dr. Wayne Frederick. Lines are open if you have a question or comment for Dr. Frederick at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before the break, Dr. Frederick, you were talking about the climate, the atmosphere when you went out to Silicon Valley. Talk to me a little bit more about that, because I would say here on the East Coast, we often hear things that are so very, very different. We are buttoned down here from D.C. to New York to Atlanta. And, you know, but there's a whole lot of money out there and everybody's wearing flip flops and shorts. But beyond that, what else did you sense and see?
Yeah, but you see that talking about how people dress, how people present themselves is just one aspect of, I think, a bigger cultural construct in which people are in a very creative mode. They are not bound in any way, shape, or form. And I think that symbolism is also very important in terms of the creativity that exists, in terms of how the workspaces are created, how people interact, how people are willing to accept ideas that are controversial and very disruptive to what the norm is. And I think all of that we can learn from. It's difficult, I think, in a traditional higher ed setting, as always, to necessarily recreate that environment. We're trying to do that with the Innovation Lab we now have on campus and these other types of things. When we look at the renovation for the library, we're trying to do the same thing to create a different type of space in which students would study and get information, etc. Getting the students out there to immerse themselves in the culture and to spend time in the culture, I think, is important, because I think that gives them an opportunity to see what it's like, to understand it. And also it gives Google an opportunity to really interact with them well. The press releases underplayed this point, but the other important point that I think needs to be clear is we'll also be carrying HBCU faculty out there as well as part of this program. The goal being for them to come back and change the curriculum and change how they do things so that these students could be even better prepared. So we really think that we are at the front, really the front edge of addressing the diversity issue, and that this could really create a wave and a model for how to do it. We're starting with a summer program where the students will spend 12 weeks and get 12 credits, but my ultimate goal is for us to have a program where they're out there year-round and they can really interact and engage with the students.
What kind of conversations did you have about diversity with the Silicon Valley leadership out there? Because, you know, as you suggested, there's been kind of a groundswell. There were reports, you know, 4 or 5 years ago that, you know, Silicon Valley as a whole did not have a lot of minorities. And then we've seen not just, you know, the Googles and the Yahoos and the Facebooks. We've also even seen Microsoft, for example. Mm-hmm. What are they saying about that?
Yeah, I think they're genuinely concerned. And the first step they took was actually collecting the data and publishing it. And you have to commend them for that. But it can't stop there. You know, we know that there's a problem and we have to come up with solutions. We had a Google in residence professor here. Yet still, over the course of the four-year period, we really had just a couple of our students graduate and be hired there. We think that there's an opportunity to accelerate that. Now, in fairness to Google as well, that Google in residence professor, this would be the first class, I believe, that would graduate where the Google in residence professor was here fully from their freshman year. And so we'll see what impact that has. But the point is that this needs to be accelerated. I think there's genuine concern, but a lot more has to be done about it in order to change those numbers.
You mentioned the incubator. Talk to me about that, because there was the grand opening recently.
So we have an incubator on campus, which we are doing in conjunction with the city. Mayor Bowser and her team came to us. This is an inclusive innovation incubator. We're calling it IN3. And the goal here, again, is to bring venture capitalists to the campus and to the city, where they can really interact with entrepreneurs, and primarily we want to focus on minorities. And this is really a full service incubator where people can rent space. Obviously, there's computing power there. Cisco has been very generous with their support of this project as well, in terms of what they have set up for video conferencing, et cetera. Some of their latest and best technology is in the space. And so we're very excited about this project and the opportunities that I think it will provide.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the renovation for the library. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. This summer we're planning to renovate the undergraduate library. And we'd like to obviously bring it into a very contemporary look and feel. Students today do require some quiet spaces, but libraries are very active places now. That active learning engagement is a big part of what we're doing, and that's what we intend to do with this renovation of that space.
How have libraries changed? As you are well aware, Martin Luther King's library, the Martin Luther King Library downtown in D.C., undergoing major renovation, and even some could argue that the role of books are not playing are not being played up as high as digital. But as old school as I am, I still think there is a place for putting your hand on a book.
Absolutely. There's no doubt that there's an opportunity and a place for that. But what we have to recognize is that the current learners are coming through a system where they're being taught in a very digital-oriented fashion, where there's a lot of visualization, there's a lot of interaction and engagement. And I think that the biggest thing about it is that we have to recognize that libraries are no longer places to store books, but we have to look at them in terms of what they really have always been, which were places to obtain information as well as to share it. And I think that sharing part is a big part of what needs to be emphasized. So people being able to study in small groups, discuss things, write on boards where they can express their ideas and digest them. That exchange and interchange, I think, is a big part of what libraries have to provide. Quite outside of what they did at the turn of the prior century, where the storage of books and that accessibility to information was probably more emphasized. I think now how that information is used and shared is where our libraries have to be.
Yeah, because I think about, my daughter. She's here, and if she wants to know something, just like her, her contemporaries, they go to the computer and they grab their information there. And libraries to be relevant, you got to give them a reason to go.
That's true. But also, I would also say that in an academic setting such as ours, the other thing that we want to do out of the library experience is to make sure that attainment of information is not done in isolation, right? Because we now have young people who are spending so much time behind computers, behind laptops, behind phones, that one of the things that we're hearing from employers is how well do they interact with one another? How well do they assimilate the environments? How well do they deal with conflict? And so, again, really pushing the spaces in the library to create that opportunity for them to have to do that, work in teams, to work together, to have conflict, to resolve it based on ideas, et cetera, is going to be a very important role, I think, for the library on a university campus like ours. And so, yes, we will have the spaces for books, and we will have that isolated, quiet space for people to do their own thing. But we must also create opportunities for more interaction and engagement around the attainment of knowledge.
I wanted to mention one thing I forgot, something that, of course, was in the newscast, this just coming out. Queen Bee, Beyonce, offering scholarships to women at Howard University, Spelman, two other schools that are not HBCUs. Even outside of her popularity, I mean, she really is probably, the highest profile black woman next to Oprah. And there are all kinds of scholarships available. But, what does this say when someone like that, singles out, a Howard University or a Spelman?
Well, I think it's a recognition again of, what HBCUs have contributed and what we continue to contribute in terms of academia for the society and specifically for women. And I think that at recognizing us in that way and supporting our students has to be commended. And I really appreciate this down payment that she's making on, the nation's future.
Let's talk a little bit about scholars. We talk about them quite frequently here, and one could argue that they don't always make the news. But the reality is that these are the people that in some way, shape, or form are going to be running the world. The Fulbright scholars that are coming through. Let's talk about that first.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We have four Howard University students and two recent alum who have obtained Fulbright. And I have to tell you, these are amazing young people. I had the opportunity myself to meet and interview for my radio show, The Journey, three of them. And the types of things that these young people are thinking about getting involved in and trying to do are things that will change the world. And the fact that they also see the importance of the global experience in terms of not just obtaining knowledge but applying research to problems that they have seen is fascinating. I mean, one of them was in Germany, in Berlin, and she, looking at Syrian refugees in that country, the struggles that they have and trying to come up with a project that can impact that. There's a young woman interested in becoming a neurosurgeon who's had some incredible experiences doing research in the summers while here at Howard at some really high-powered labs where the opportunity to do that and the number of African-American female neurosurgeons, unfortunately, in this country, you can still count on one hand. And that is, something that, again, Howard University has to add to those numbers. And so while her road ahead is one less traveled, I feel very comfortable that her preparation and what she wants to do will certainly get her there. So the types of things that these folks are doing, Harold, it's just absolutely amazing. And the fact that we continue to have scholars at the university that are obtaining these types of awards and opportunities says a lot about the university.
And we've got a Truman Scholar, Deonte Bell, not as well known as it relates to scholars. What is the Truman Scholarship?
Yeah, so, Truman Scholarship is a premier graduate scholarship for aspiring public service leaders in the U.S., and Deonte is Howard University's 10th winner since '89. If you look at the history of the university in terms of all of these types of scholars, whether it's Truman, Marshall, Rhodes, and now the Schwartzman that we have won in our history, we've won 12 of them. And in the past 24 months, we have now won 5 of these. And it says a lot about what the faculty and staff here at the university are doing along with the students. We now have 2 Trumans. This is back-to-back years. We've won the Truman Scholar. We've had a student win a Truman Scholarship Award. A few months ago, we won a Rhodes and a Schwartzman. And previously, we won a Marshall. So we've created an Office of Undergraduate Studies with a division focused on honors and these prestigious scholarships. And they have really been working with the students. I mean, this coming year, we probably have some 70-something students that are showing an interest in applying for these various awards. So adding to the ranks of African-American scholars who obtain these through Howard University is going to be another part of our calling card into the future.
I need to take a break. When we come back, more to talk about, including HBCU rally. Also, what's going on in New York with free tuition? That's raising a lot of eyebrows as well. We're talking to Howard University President Dr. Wayne Frederick. Lines are open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation with Howard University President Dr. Wayne Frederick. Before I get to those other issues, Dr. Frederick, I wanted to ask you about the Faculty Senate Council's vote of no confidence in you. I know it may for some people seem like inside baseball, but give me kind of a thumbnail sketch of what this means and your reaction to it.
Sure. You know, a couple of things. First is the politics of it and what occurred and the questions that have risen about how this was conducted, et cetera. I'm not going to get into the weeds. I think the Faculty Senate Council, that's their business, and that's what they've got to you know, sort out on their own. I'm more concerned about any issues or concerns that are legitimate that need to be addressed. And so I've been having an ongoing conversation. The Faculty Senate Chair is someone that I've invited to my cabinet meetings, et cetera. He's never raised any of these concerns over the course of the past 2 years. And so that's what my disappointment is, if there are any concerns that needed to be raised. I think that was a forum to raise them. We also meet monthly, not just with him, but with the Vice President and the Secretary. And I think he had a lot of opportunity to bring that to the table. And so there's been a recent election. There's a new Faculty Senate Chair elect. And so, you know, my administration is committed to continuing to take that feedback and to continue to engage with the Faculty Senate leadership, because shared governance is one of the principles that we have to operate on.
Now certainly when you're talking about, you know, faculty members, certainly you would want to, you know, have a good relationship with the faculty leadership. Is there a resolution to, you know, some of the, you know, complaints about transparency and concerns about, you know, the financial situation with the university? And how would you address that with them?
Yeah, I think what we'll do is continue to be transparent. I think we've been very transparent. Faculty serve on committees. At the board level, I've successfully rallied the board leadership to add faculty members to key committees that they never served on before, such as real estate, health sciences, et cetera. So we're going to continue to do all of those things. I think in terms of accessibility, in terms of talking about the university, in terms of putting out information through the State of the University address, I think I've done that in a very transparent and open fashion. I think we'll continue to do that. With respect to the finances of the university, you know, I think one of the things that we have to accept is the reality of our circumstance. And I'm not going to, you know, have what I like to refer to as happy speak, where I'm going to paint a picture that isn't. The circumstances for the university in terms of revenue and expenses is a very tight one. Our dependency on the federal appropriation is something that we have to be cautious about. We have to raise more money. We have to do a better job with philanthropy. And that's why we're focused on trying to build the infrastructure around the ability to perform a capital campaign. I think all of those are principles that we must engage.
And to that point, on Thursday, there is going to be a National HBCU Day of Action as it relates to urging members of Congress to support HBCUs and other black institutions of higher learning. We saw, obviously, what happened during these first months of the Trump administration with HBCUs. The proposed funding for HBCUs from the Trump administration is essentially flat. Appealing to Congress, is that a better route?
So a couple of things. Actually, the funding is not flat. I mean, that's what the White House has advertised. But at the same time, that skinny budget also included decreasing funding to NIH and NSF, which means that will potentially harm monies that will come into all higher institutions, of which Howard University is one of those research universities in America, and therefore that could harm us.
Do you say it's less?
It's less. Okay, proposed cut, I believe, is something like 18% cut to NIH funding in his budget. That's one. Two, he has proposed cuts for SEOG grants. These are grants that go to disadvantaged students. Disadvantaged students attend HBCUs. And if they have less funding, then less of them will come. That will potentially harm us. Work study. There's a proposed cut in work study funding. Disadvantaged students at HBCUs rely on work study to obviously pay expenses, living expenses, et cetera. Again, that would potentially harm us. So there's several other things in the package that I think ultimately could and will harm HBCUs if it's accepted. We have to continue to appeal to Congress in terms of making sure that both sides of the aisle are clear about the return on investment that you get from supporting HBCUs. And Howard University has to be at the forefront of such a discussion. I think a rally around this, and I have to take the opportunity to commend Representative Adams, who has spearheaded this effort to start a bipartisan HBCU caucus. I think it really is the type of initiative that is timely and necessary for us to make sure that HBCU funding in general is really put on the front burner of the Congress's eye. The last thing I'll say, Howell, on this issue, and I think that the data is scary, and we need to make sure that people are hearing these things and looking at this carefully. HBCUs represent 3-4% of the higher ed institutions in this country, but are responsible for over 20% of the bachelor's degrees that are awarded to African Americans in this country. The outstrip role we play in sending African Americans to medical school is an example. When you look at what we do around sending students from our undergrad programs to STEM PhDs, right? The top 10 schools that do that are HBCUs. And Howard University, in particular, over the past decade, the last time NSF published data, we sent more students to STEM PhDs than Stanford, Harvard, Yale, and MIT combined. So the outstrip role that we're playing in this country right now in terms of diversifying significant fields, dentistry, you look at Howard and Meharry, we probably account for 40-50% of the black dentists that come out every year. These are outstrip roles that we're playing, and therefore having flat funding or taking away funding that supports disadvantaged students is going to harm HBCUs, period.
And to that point, I'm sure you've, you know, kind of been watching the news as it relates to New York making, you know, tuition free for, you know, public colleges for, you know, middle class and lower income students. Is that a slippery slope for even private institutions?
You know, these things have to be managed, and we have to look at what these outcomes are going to be. You have some great public institutions in New York, no doubt, but you also have quite a variety of private institutions. And one of the fears is that especially the private liberal arts colleges could really be hurt by something like this. And I think that we all are going to have to be vigilant to see how the program is managed. There are proposed changes over time in terms of the income level at which this would kick in, etc. I think that there's a lot in the fine print that people need to be aware of. You know, you have to be at a certain income level or below to qualify, etc. So there's several other things embedded in here that we will have to observe. A lot of the private liberal arts colleges in New York probably do charge significant tuitions and probably do have significant number of paying students whose parents come from a different income bracket, and so you may be competing. But those schools need a diversity of students in order to ensure that the environment can be as rich as possible. And that might be what gets harmed first before, you know, a drop in enrollment that people are, you know, are concerned they may see down the pipeline if more of the students are, you know, are gravitating towards the public institutions.
Something to think about. Dr. Frederick, always good to see you. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you again in the next month or so.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Tuesday, April 25th. I'm Harold Fisher. You can follow me on Twitter at HFisherWHUR or at Daily Drum WHUR. Now, stay tuned for The Connection with Lorna Newton.